Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare, educational, and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore, and thanks for joining us again. In this episode, Samantha Krieger joins us in the second part of our case study on the Butler University Sciences Complex addition and renovation. Before we begin, let me introduce our guest. Samantha Krieger is an interior designer with BSA and holds RID, NCIQ, and IIDA certifications. A graduate of Purdue University, she earned a Bachelor of Arts in Interior Design and in French. Before joining BSA in 2015, Samantha worked for Roland Design. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I like to start out by asking people what got them into their profession. What interested you in interior design? Where does that passion come from?
Yeah, I wish I had some profound, like, I just knew design was for me. I loved interiors. Like, honestly, it was one of those where, like, I loved art in high school and I was really good at it, but I was also good at math, but I didn't foresee myself going into being, like, starving artist, create. Like, I wasn't that good at art. Ironically, I did always love, like, rearranging my bedroom as a kid, and, like, you know, inflatable furniture was really popular when I was growing up, and new bedspread and rearrange, you know, when you just get excited doing that. So
yes,
that does not mean that inspired my career. It just naturally was something that I was good at. And I remember as a kid, we had an assignment for one of our, I don't know, probably an elementary school. You had to, like, draw your fire escape plan, like family safety. And I, like, drew a floor plan of our entire house and, like, showed my parents. My dad's like, oh my God, you drew it, like, practically to scale, because I just loved spatial everything. But I'm like, I was not passionate, like, I'm going to go into interior design. I actually applied to be in marketing at Purdue University,
okay,
thinking, like, graphics, marketing. But when you're at Purdue, that falls under, like, the College of Agriculture. And so totally wasn't the right level of marketing. So even before I even started at Purdue, I'd already changed my major, like, come January before I even started. I was like, I don't think marketing's the right approach. So I was like, maybe interior design. I'm like, that's art and math and creativity, but a good foundation of, like, a four-year degree. It's a full-blown career, not starving artist. So luckily, it was the right fit for me right off the bat. I did all 4 years there. I loved it, found a job that I still love. So I am passionate about it, but it wasn't one of these.
Right.
Like, I knew exactly what I was going to do. It was one of those, like, you're 18, what are you going to do? You, like, kind of hope you pick something that works. And, like, luckily I did, and it is the right field for me. So I think my passion has grown since I've started, but it wasn't one of those, like, oh my gosh, yes, I'm destined.
I love
this
so much. It's interesting you drew that back to being younger and rearranging. I did that all the time.
I know everyone does it. Like, I think everybody loved doing that, but I'm like, I loved it. Like, that inspired me.
There is some creativity to it. Yeah. I mean, depending on how big your room is and how many things you've got in there, I used to do it every few months.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Especially, like, in my teenage years. It was it was like a creative outlet. It was like, what happens if I put the bed here, you know, and the desk, like, over here?
People don't realize how much interior design impacts, like, your daily life. Like, obviously, you said you did it too. I'm like, you're not an interior designer anymore or ever, but you still understand that, like, that brings that sense of, like, new and refresh and excitement. Like, that is what interiors does, whether you realize.
Change the traffic flow, you know, all about it.
Yeah.
Well, then maybe when we're done with this, I'll just come join the interior.
You should. Yeah, you've got a passion for it.
Well, along with your degree in interior design, you also majored in French, which I found was interesting. Mm-hmm. What brought that on? And have you been able to travel to France to use it?
I did one of those things where I just took it through middle school and then high school. And then when you take your competency test going in, I tested very high into French for Purdue, like level 4. So I'm like, a couple more classes I can knock out a minor in it. Yeah. Why not? Which I was like, not to sell it short, but, like, we were reading full-blown novels in French and writing papers. I'm like, I think back. I'm like, I honestly have never used it since then. I have traveled to France a few times, just, you know, over the summer. And I did an exchange program with a family. But honestly, that was just, like, a convenience, like, just tested high. I'm like, I totally probably lost most of it. But I was like, I used to read full-blown novels in French and we're, like, writing papers. I'm like, I totally forgot. But probably could, you know, pick up a few things.
Sure.
Like, you know, you read the back of the shampoo bottle. It's got some French in there. I, like, test myself. I'm like, do I know what that's saying? And then I read the English part. I'm like, okay, I still got it. I kind of understood that.
It's these random times where you're reading a label and you're like, can I?
Can I still do it?
Probably not the most applicable one here in the United States, but like still a cool fact. Sure. Right.
Did it work pretty well when you went over there? Like, were you able to understand
it?
Everything?
When I was younger and we would go, I definitely was more competent in it. They speak so fast though, too. It's definitely different. But I think at one point I was pretty fluent, I would say, but it's a lost art a little bit at this point. But
that's great. That's great. So the real reason I brought you on was not to talk about your French or anything like that. But in our last episode, we talked to Stacey O'Reilly, a professor at Butler University, about the Sciences Complex Edition of Renovation. And we were able to get some insights from her on from a client perspective. You worked on this project, so I wanted to have you on to discuss some of these finer details that stand out. From Stacey's perspective, the project was a long time coming. When did you get involved and what was your role in the project?
Yeah, definitely agree about it being a long time coming. I actually started with BSA in 2015, right as this project was coming online.
Oh.
So I would say this has kind of been my baby since I started my career with BSA. So that was right as we started jumping into programming and schematic design and everything. And obviously the two existing buildings that are there that have been renovated, we're in just desperate need and ready for the renovation. So I totally agree that it was a long time coming. But also looking at, you know, on our end, even before I started at BSA, this project had been on their master plan and in production a long time before I even started.
She said this was like the third iteration, that they had sat through to try to, wow.
So to say it was a long time coming is no joke. And then for us to actually start, you know, our portion of the job in 2015 and now it's, you know, 2024, you look, yes, it is completed, but the ups and downs that this project even went through, you know, from starting in 2015, then we went on hold and then we got funding and then we went on hold because another building kind of leapfrogged us on campus. And so for it to finally complete, you know, wrap up and be ready to go 2022, 2023, like that was really like the bow on the project. But like, yes, this was a long time coming considering we spent 8 or 9 years kind of on again, off again in the design and construction phase. So to see it complete now is like a miracle. And I remember we had some students come visit us in 2016, maybe, and we were talking about this exciting project that we were working on. And I was sharing with them, I'm like, the scale of the projects that we do are so complex and they're big, like this one won't even be done until 2020. So I'm like, for what I'm working on now, like, we won't even see this complete for another 4 years, which is funny to think about now because we had no idea a pandemic was coming and, you know, that other things were going to, you know, put constraints on the project and construction and all that. So looking back, I'm like, oh my God, it would have been a miracle if we had gotten this done by 2020. But
yeah,
I mean, it still is crazy because a lot of this work was done then in 2020, 2021. We still had a lot of remaining design work, construction, the furniture process, everything. So when we say it was a long time coming, like I think everybody agrees just because there were so many, you know, uphill battles we fought to get to this point. And for it to be as successful as it was, it just, there was a lot of adaptation on our end, on the client side, on the contractor end. So I think everybody like breathes a collective sigh of relief now that it is done. It's functioning and it's successful. I think a lot of people hold this one near and dear to their heart just because of what it went through. It's really cool to see it done and thriving.
So I want to talk about some specific things within the project that I found were interesting that we wanted to share. There's an amazing atrium wall that the project team was able to do something really cool with that I wanted you to share a story about. And you've already told me this, but can you talk about the backstory of the donor wall?
Yes. And it is beautiful, but it's funny to think of where we started. So when you look at this new atrium, it's kind of that curved portion that joins the two buildings together. And we had grand ideas for, you've got this big front door right next to it. You walk into this big, expansive open atrium. We had a beautiful monumental stair planned originally. Come to find out when you start talking demo and working with structural, there is a big, massive shear wall and stairs that back up, poured in place stairs that are there. That was a no-go, can't touch it, can't remove it. The existing building is going to fall down. So as designers, we're like, oh, that's like a pierce to the heart. I'm like, you're ruining our walk in the front door aha moment.
You're ruining my vision.
Yes, I'm like, we don't have this big, grand, open aha moment to our atrium anymore. So that was a curveball that we're like, are you sure? Can we punch into it a little bit? I mean, it's like a 2-foot deep shear wall. You can't do anything to it except live with it and work with it. And so that then, because it wasn't moving, we had to pivot our thinking. Well, that, you know, that wall was there, that stair was there. It doesn't really make sense to have two monumental stairs within proximity of each other. So it's kind of where we eliminated that big monumental stair and decided to celebrate this big, massive object that got put right in the middle of the room. So because we have this 10-foot wide, 3-story high wall that's not going to move, we decided we better celebrate it. And so you know, we had talked about, let's put in a green wall, let's put in some live plants. This is science, this is nature.
Yeah, but
I mean, just even getting electrical, a watering system, everything to this solid mass just was not feasible. And so we since extracted that and we're like, let's do something, you know, a nod to a green. We also needed some acoustical benefits. So we ended up peppering in all these really cool kind of DNA sequencey looking acoustical panels in various shades of green that kind of emulate a green wall. I mean, it's green, but more of a plant wall, which then developed into university advancement side. They're like, this would be a great opportunity for a donor wall. So from there spurred these wooden plaques that you now see on the wall that host various donors to the project, have a, get a wooden plaque with their name on and everything. And the wooden plaque is a unique story in its own.
This is the part I really wanted to talk about too.
In order to complete construction of the building, unfortunately, there was this huge, old, beautiful walnut tree right smack dab in the middle of the project site that unfortunately was just going to be a kind of a ramification of construction.
It had to go, unfortunately.
So there was just a lot of talk of like, what can we use with that? We definitely want to celebrate it. Can we turn it into furniture? Can we, you know, carve it into a table? Can we make something? So eventually it translated into milling down that tree into wood veneer to use somewhere in the building, which if you look at our renderings and our photography, we really were going for this very light wood tone, a natural ash, very light, airy, bright, modern look. So to hear that it was a walnut tree, which, you know, is beautiful and timeless, but it is not that bright, beautiful, ash-like toned wood. So again, the design team's like, oh, does it have to be walnut? We have ash everywhere else. But ultimately, we think it adds a very nice level of warmth into our building. And you would never know that, like, it's not that deep, traditional, heavy, heavy walnut. It's got a really beautiful, warm glow to it. It just adds some richness. It really does tie in when you look at all the wood tones throughout the building. It does tie itself in beautifully. But again, the design team, oh my God, walnut veneer in our all ash building. Are you kidding?
Well, and I know people didn't want to, like, they knew the tree had to come down, but people were sad about it.
Oh, too. It was like a very highly beautiful.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's our walnut tree, you know? Yeah. And to be able to take that and to make it into something that still exists in the building, I just thought it was
and
so
And to
cool.
be celebrated. I'm like, I don't know if everybody will ever know that or remember that part of the story, but it really is something that we originally were faced with as a challenge. It turned out to be so beautiful. And so, I mean, it is special even for those donors, whether they know it or not. I'm like, that bit of wood and that part of the tree is like such a part of the history of this building and that project. Whether people know it or not, it's a very cool story behind it.
I feel like that's one of our core skills too, is like really listening to our clients. And as the process is unfolding, solving problems or challenges that aren't necessarily part of the scope, right? But they're important nonetheless. Would you say that's true as well?
Oh my gosh, yes. Yeah. That, I mean, just because, you know, removing a tree that's been on campus for 50 plus years can be met with some resistance because it's been there and it's old. Those don't just pop up overnight.
So, and they're probably a core memory, I think, for people that have been on campus, you know, decades before. Yeah. And when they come back, they have these fond memories of, I don't know, sitting under that tree and reading a book or it was just there outside their window. And you've got professors that have taught there for decades. And it's like, no, that's my tree, you know, and I don't want to lose it. So being able to hear that and still figure out a way to solve that problem is very cool.
Yeah, I would say we definitely were like, are we sure we need to use it? It's walnut. But I'm like so glad we have that story now and they have that story. Yeah. A huge credit to their university advancement team that really helped push that idea along and got these plaques made in the exact same shape as the rest of the acoustic panels that go up. I mean, it's just, I'm so glad they kept pushing for that. That really is something that is
I wanted to thank you for sharing that because that was something I wanted to kind of push on is, BSA listens to their clients. It's not just here's our solution and take it, you know. So let's talk terrazzo.
Yeah.
If I'm pronouncing that correctly. How did you use terrazzo to create connections in the interior space?
Yeah. So obviously we love terrazzo. It is a timeless material. It comes with a high cost and, you know, price point, but it is one of those materials that once you get it in there, if you can maintain it, it'll last the lifetime in the building. Yeah. The same thing is true for part of the existing part of Gallagher Hall, that main atrium. We didn't do much renovation in there except, you know, new paint, new lighting, new ceilings, but the original curved staircase in that part of the building stayed, as well as all the terrazzo in that poured in place terrazzo stair. So we were able to take that. We had a really good contractor that was really very good at holding hands and helping us through the process of maintaining and restoring that floor that had been there for 50 plus years. So you may not even know if you were to look at it today, they did such a good job restoring it. But polished it, cleaned it. There are some visible cracks that have been filled, but that's just part of the nature
the
of Toronto.
It's
been there forever. Yeah. So that we're able to restore that floor, bring it back up to a really nice high level of polished and clean. And then we did add some new terrazzo into the new portion of the building, which was kind of a nod to that existing terrazzo. They don't touch directly, but now kind of each of these two main entrances to the building kind of have that timeless material kind of tying them together.
It's so really cool.
It was cool to be able to keep that. And I mean, the history is there. So I definitely go check it out. You'd be so surprised how good it looks now. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And I think I've said this. My son is a senior there and he plays baseball at Butler University. And he goes into this building all the time to sit in that area and study and just brags about how beautiful it is.
Awesome. So, yeah.
The interior atrium, like we were discussing a few minutes ago and I just alluded to, which is one of the spots that my son thinks is so fantastic, is I know that used to be the exterior space. How did you go about converting that and making it into a useful space for the students and the faculty?
Yeah, so as we have talked before, you know, this project had been in the works years and years before our design team even got on board. And, you know, there'd been a lot of schematic design and renderings and, you know, all these initial ideas. And there's these very rigid existing buildings. It's Gallahue Hall and Holcomb. Very two rigid, brutalist, rough, solid limestone buildings. So the connector point is where our new atrium lives, right in between there. And that's where we introduced this really soft, subtle curve to the atrium from the exterior. So it's really this beautiful juxtaposition of very hard, rigid, rectangular to this really soft, beautiful, curved atrium. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of complements the both of them and really brings them together as like, oh, I can tell this is where these two points are converging. I remember when we did some initial site walks, standing outside the two buildings, because they did not really connect at the time of, you know, before the renovation. So standing outside, you just look at what you're working with. You're like, someday we will be on the interior of this at some point. And you can still see, you know, once we've enclosed this atrium, you still see some of those exterior points that I've brought into the building.
But right.
It's just this like point where all of this converges. And that was the whole point of this project, was just bringing and connecting everything together, this addition smack dab right in the middle. So it really is where all the sciences come together, figuratively and, you know, creatively.
And I should say for our listeners, I've got a link in the show notes directly to the project page on our website, where there's a gallery full of images that you can see and kind of visualize what Sam is describing in a lot of these things. So I understand that the lighting in the atrium is also quite unique as well, correct?
Yeah, I'd say that was one of the, not curveball, but unique challenges that was posed to the design team. Because we do have this three-story atrium, there was a request from the maintenance side to not have any lighting up in that three-story ceiling. Because in order, you know, when a light fixture goes out or needs to be accessed, it's just really not feasible to get a lift in there, a scissor lift that can go up three stories. So we were tasked with lighting that whole three-story volume from the second floor or below, which there, you know, the ceiling is only up over the third floor, to work with our engineers and our lighting designers to figure out a way to light this room. You know, it's a lot of glass, but at night it's dark, you know, 5 p.m. in the winter, you're dark, you're going to need some light. And so that was one of the challenges we had, that they really pushed us on that one. And it really, we had to flex our design muscles to figure out, how do we light this without lighting it from above? We've got this, you know, 32 foot wide atrium that, how are we going to do this? So we were able to, you know, kind of spotlight it from the side, also wash our donor walls, see that, you know, make it a feature at night. So it really does glow from the exterior. But when you look at that ceiling, you will see there are no lights up there, but the space still feels bright. It's well illuminated. It's, you know, appropriate light levels for studying at night.
That's an amazing solution.
Just strategically using lights and where you place them and where they're hidden without, you know, glaring directly in to a light fixture. So that, I mean, we spent weeks trying to figure that out. So that I appreciate Butler pushing us on that, because it really did challenge us to think outside the box for how we make the lighting work in there.
There's also something different about the windows too. Can you tell us about the Fibonacci sequencing within the building's concept story?
Yes. So this is where I'm going to try not to go so, you know, abstracty, artsy. But we were partnered with Browning Day on this project. They worked on the exterior of the building, and specifically Dan Overby, great designer, great, you know, great art, came up with this concept, kind of, it's called the Fibonacci sequence. So that is a real thing.
Yes.
And that is where you take the sum of numbers in a sequence, so like in order, so 1 + 1 = 2, then 2 + 1, that, so it's basically the number before preceded adding, it's this natural sequence of numbers. So Dan took that kind of sequence of numbers and decided to kind of apply that just to the mullion spacing in increments of, you know, first mullion is here, the next number in the sequence is one, so we move that one 1 feet away. Then 1 + 1 = 2, so that mullion is now 2 feet apart. Two and so on. So 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, and so on. We kind of created this abstracted sequence of patterning just through linear mullions. Right. So if you step outside the building and you kind of look at the array of the mullions that go around the building, there is a mathematical rhythm to it. And then we did bring some of that in inside the building in some paint patterning. Some of our fabrics have a nod to the linear there.
I just think that's so cool.
I know. It's this crazy abstracted thing, but it
and most people are going to look at it and have no idea. And that's what Stacy mentioned when we were talking about it. She was like, it's a cool thing, but a lot of people don't know, which is why I wanted to tell the story about it. Yeah.
And it's also like Fibonacci sequence in nature is a thing. It's kind of called a hidden order. So when you look at like a pine cone, the base of it, you see all these little nodes that start forming a kind of a circular pattern, or like the head of a sunflower seed, the way the seeds and then the petals start doing this array, or a succulent plant. If you Google images, you'll see what we're talking about. And so that was somewhat the inspiration behind our wood ceiling. At one time, we did have it a little bit more dimensional, but it, you know, just practicality and acoustics and everything, it ended up being a little bit flatter. But if you look at our wood ceiling, it's kind of emulating that natural order of what you would see in a pine cone or, you know, something in nature. Just the average person would not ever know that. We just subtle nods and been brought into the building.
I wanted to ask you about the science library and the backstory there, which is what the project team tackled with renovations that address durability, cleanability. I don't even know if that's a word. I might have just made it up.
No, I
didn't. Okay, good. Cleanability and maintainability. Can you share some of that?
Yeah. So the science library in the initial building was this very highly political, highly specialized, very important, and still is to this day, but just wanted known on campus as one of the best places to go study, to read books, to camp out all day. So knowing that it was going to be touched during the renovation, there was a lot of meetings and discussions and, you know, bringing in a bunch of groups to review, just because it wasn't your average just renovation of a library. The initial library, existing library, was on two different stories. It wasn't super accessible. I think there was an elevator, but you had to get outside. You had to leave the library, take the elevator up to the next floor,
and then come back. Yeah.
Wow. And then there was a leaky skylight and, you know, just not a ton of windows and everything. So the new reimagined library was intended to keep that same like highly praised and coveted spot, to making it a little bit more accessible, providing a little bit more seating, a lot more daylight into the space. So there was just a lot of thought and care that went into that. Did bring it all onto one level. It is fully accessible. There was a slight reduction in the stacks and the books, but certainly still kept a majority of a lot of the books there. And then the thought behind the library is that it was kind of really self-policed and student enforced, as far as, you know, it's a quiet place to study. And we, you know, it's there's some seniority to who uses the library and, you know, how it gets policed. And so the design for it, a little bit, the way you kind of enter the main portion of the library, you can, you know, you check in, there's the welcome desk, we've got some collaborative seating out front, but then as you start making your way towards the back of the library, it kind of follows this subtle curve around the stacks. We kind of started zoning the furniture, you know, the main public area is your most collaborative, the furniture is conducive to group work. As you kind of get towards the middle of the library, we've got some tables and chairs, but thinking, you know, some higher backed lounge seats, and thinking it's smaller groups or it's a little bit more quiet study, that's where the study rooms start getting introduced. And then as you make your way to the back, that's where we have these kind of custom built study carrels. So in the old library, it used to be these old rickety wooden hunky pieces of furniture that everyone has seen and probably used, and students loved them, just weren't able to bring those over. You know, we wanted to start fresh. Towards the back, which is where we kind of see our zone getting the most quiet, that is where we have these kind of custom-built study carrels that have acoustic panels around them. They've got marker boards in there. There's a bunch of power. It's kind of along the windows. So I think those are still the highly sought-after.
I was going to say, I would have loved to use that when I was in school, right?
You were able to maintain the, you know, the sacred nature of the library, but just give it a facelift and with accessibility, and the lighting is
the
good.
Lighting is huge. Yeah.
It's probably the best view on campus because they just have this beautiful full expanse of windows that overlook the canals. I think they're happy with how it turned out, but it was definitely a feat to get, you know, we're touching the library.
Right.
We promise we will do a good job, but we just felt there was so much importance to that space. So it wasn't our average design space that we had.
How has this project translated into other projects that you've worked on or that you're working on now, such as lessons learned or considerations you now make?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, since it was one of the first projects I worked on with BSA, I would say having Butler as our client, I personally have just learned so much from them. They have a very high level of expectation and really good standards that they hold all of their, you know, we are their client as well. So, you know, us partnering with them, they hold us to a very high standard for design and cleanability and maintainability. And, you know, we suggest something that's a crazy abstract design idea. And, you know, they kind of bring us back down to reality. Well, we don't think we can maintain that. So, right. You know, causing us to pivot like, okay, let's try this. You know, we hear you. We understand that's a constraint. Let's try this. So there was a lot of push and pull where they really kind of, you know, held us to please make sure you're designing something that we can maintain that is also beautiful. And so we've learned so much from them. Anyway, I think one of the facts I shared with you when we went through this entire furniture process, you know, yeah. We've got about $3 million worth of new furniture on this project. Working with them, they said, you know, that's a lot of furniture for us to maintain as well. So we don't want a ton of different fabrics. We don't want a ton of different manufacturers. We, you know, if a chair breaks, I don't want to have to look through a list of 20 manufacturers to figure out who it was. I can confidently say we have basically narrowed it down to about 8 different fabrics used strategically on it. I mean, that is a lot of furniture to kind of make a cohesive design on just 8 fabrics. And so you'll see a lot of the similar, you know, fabrics and materials used throughout, but I don't think you'll notice that there's a ton of repetition just based on how we used it. But on a project of that scale, you would see upwards of 20, 30, just different applications or what's approved on a certain piece for use. So I have definitely, I mean, moving forward from that changed my thinking a little bit in that we don't have to go crazy excessive on a lot of stuff to make it look beautiful and also give our clients something that functions and works well for them. So right. I totally credit Butler for pushing us and helping us understand, you know, from a client's perspective, what's acceptable or what's feasible for them. So I'm like, that has totally changed my thinking moving forward for so many projects. The challenge at the time, but I'm like, it has totally shaped me as a designer and, you know, just kind of thinking with a different hat on sometimes as we're designing and pulling and working. So I definitely credit them for.
Yeah, because that creative side of you, of course, wants to. Let's go crazy. Let's get as much as we can, you know.
They're going to bring us back down to reality. And so I really appreciate them for pushing us. And, you know, it definitely has helped future clients, too, as we come to the table with, you know, that experience of like, hey, this is what's worked really well for this client. Here's how we were able to achieve it. I think it's still working well for them. You know, just for us to be reasonable and, you know, professional, it definitely has shaped us. So I thank them so much for that experience.
Well, thank you for coming on. I thought it was super important to have like this has been such a successful project that talking to Stacy and talking to you kind of gives us both sides of the coin, if you will. And I'd love to have you back on again in the future.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Samantha for joining us on this episode of BSA by Design. We hope you've enjoyed our two-part case study conversation about the Butler University Sciences Complex addition and renovation. If you're interested in learning more about the project, as I said during our conversation, there's a link in the show notes. And if you want to know more about BSA Life Structures, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. With Google Podcasts going away, our feed is now available on YouTube Music. We've got a lot of great content and stories to share through various social media platforms, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.